for, since 1789, the country had been balanced around the issue of slavery. Every state was that was admitted to the Union, they admitted two at a time, slave-free, all the way up. They made so many accommodations, and then accommodations couldn't be made anymore. And that was political, but what had shifted was in the people of the country became awakened to the fact this is simply wrong, that this is wrong in so many ways. Second Great Awakening. The Third Great Awakening, according to Fogel, and he looks at these as economic events. Not just economic events, because they are religious, social, political events too. And they're not events. They are a series of interconnected events that people realize. You simply come to realize that's what we're doing. That's what we're about. And that second, that Third Great Awakening has its beginnings in the Progressive Era, 1900 to 1920. And it's the idea that some people are being left out of this growth in the country, the growth in wealth, that the huge plants and factories and mines where great fortunes were made and where people had jobs and they came to this country for jobs, but that some of these people were being left out, and it results in what he calls the welfare state. The idea of having some kind of social net through which people cannot fall. The recognition that we live in a kind of commonwealth that we need to take care of those who are the most disadvantaged and unprivileged. The Fourth Great Awakening is where he jumps off from, is the awareness that he says begins around 1960. I think you could date it earlier. That's the you don't really date these things. They simply happen. And that is, it's an awakening to the idea that, I guess I would say it becomes the movement for greater and greater inclusion. The movement to include more and more people as us. That is the falling away of differences, the recognition that we're all one. People are the same. There's something fundamental in the essence of people that is the same. For me, this came as a vital reality in an event which I've told of before, and probably some of you may have heard it. But in 1963. I was going to the Unitarian Church, and I was delighted to have found the Unitarian Church in Birmingham. But I was very active in civil rights, the black civil rights movement. And in 1963, we had a governor in Alabama named George Wallace, and he was a wonderful man, but a vicious and difficult man at the same time. And every year at the state fair, where they had Governor's Day, and he came to the state fair. And just a year before, Governor Wallace had proclaimed segregation today, segregation now, forever, etc. And I thought it would be a really good idea if we went a year later as a mixed group of black and white folk out to the state fair on Governor's Day and be in this grandstand together and waved to him, because segregation was already over in Birmingham. And, all laws were repealed on July 23, 1963, about segregation, which had been on the books for 90 years. So I felt like we were free to do this, that the laws weren't against us. But it hadn't been that long, because this is October the 15th. So we roll out to the fair, our little group, black and white, men and women, and we stroll down the midway, and we get a little ways down the midway, and it becomes apparent that we are attracting a great deal of attention, and more attention as we moved along, and then people are catcalling, and people are jumping up and down and running in our face and doing various things. But at some point, we become encircled by a large group of people, and we can go no further. And they wade into the crowd, about six or seven young men who are just frothing with anger at us and shouting the wonderful epithets, which are designed to be hurtful but are simply silly. And to make what it was a long story short, I got circled, I'm getting beaten over the head, I'm being beaten by these six or seven guys. And I don't know what happens to the other people, then I fall down on the ground, and then they begin to kick me. And there are five or six, seven of them, and they kick me. But somewhere in my mind, it has to be in my mind, I begin to see this scene. I see the scene and I stand outside the scene, really. I'm outside of the scene. And I look down and I see me on the ground and I see these guys kicking me. I also see, as I'm down on the ground, I realize I have what is known as a life review. So I see myself being born and nursing and going to school and growing up and doing this and doing that, and it's all coming fast, very, very fast. I graduate from high school, I do this, I do this, go to college, I do that, get married, all these scenes, and they just roll through me. It's just real rapid, and it comes right down to the moment of my leaving home that night, driving to the state fair, walking down that midway, and now it's focused on that scene up above. And so the camera's looking down at this, and then the camera, eye, whatever, comes down and looks at the faces of these people who are kicking me. It was around like this. I notice even in that the face of every one of those people was my face. Police, I could also see in the camera that the police had stood aside over here. Finally, the police come in. They take us in cars downtown. They question us, take fingerprints, take before a judge. And I'm charged with mob action, inciting a riot, indecent exposure, because in the course of getting beat up, I had my clothes ripped off of me. I love that. Torn away. Trousers torn away. So anyway, there were another couple of charges, but those are incidental to this story. So the judge says he released me on my own recognizance because I own a house. I'm a substantial citizen. So I go home, I take a bath, and I realize I'm all bunged up here. I've got scratches and everything is all a mess all over me, but I don't hurt. So I lay down and I'm laying in the bed and I begin to think about it. And then I remember, oh, that scene. I began to play that scene over in my mind. And then I remembered the face of every one of those boys. It was my face. Well, I was 28, 29 years old. I was a bright kid, a bright young man, I guess, and I thought I was. I thought I was smarter than I was. But anyway, I thought, what can this mean? What does it mean? And I knew that it could be interpreted in any number of ways. The way I chose to interpret it, and the way I interpreted it, was that it was me kicking me. That I could just, and part of the argument was that I could just as easily have been the kicker as the kickee. That it's only a matter of some chance that I go one way instead of another. But then I thought, it's a little deeper than that. And it came to be settled in me in a way that was non-abstract, that I was those boys. They were and are me. And that we are all connected. We're all members of one another. We're all have some essential humanness, some essential quality that connects us. And that is a reality for me. It's not an abstraction. It's not a concept. It's simply what became is for me. Now that's what Fogel says is the fourth great awakening. That awakening to the sense that we can, that there is the movement to include more and more people as us. And for me, who had been active in civil rights, where I had been urging and saying for 3.5-4 years of this, that black people are just as good as white, and that they are the same, their differences, blah, blah, I knew all that too, but that there's something essentially good about it. But in the course of that advocacy, I'd come to think in terms of categories like redneck, kluxer, evil, useless, slack, no good, violent, white trash. But after that I realized, yeah, I'm evil, violent, stupid, white trash. It's the same. So I'm not going to give, I try to give that up. These are my people too. So that came home to me. That, as I say, it came home to a reality. We'll jump ahead 30, 40 years. 30 years, 35, 37 years. I was sitting in Hardee's this morning. I'm having a senior coffee. A senior coffee for my senior moment, I guess. And I'm watching the people come and go, and I'm trying to square these folks with my idea that people are of infinite worth, and that they have inherent beauty, dignity, and rights. And then I see an old man, not unlike myself, bitter and biting with a grandchild. I see the blank faces of frightened children. I see slovenly, slack, laughing and cursing people, complaining, getting angry, ordering wrongly, protesting the service, snarling at the waitress, reviewing the truck's performance, and telling wild stories about the silly boy who's dating their daughter, the same boy about to make them grandfathers. It's as if they had no memory of love and lust and the push for connection, the urge for immortality, the crazed desire. Five women march in, loud and dismissive of men. They're telling jokes of how they've been let down. And there we are, divided, smoking and non-smoking, all ways the division. And what I see and what I hear is the sadness of anger, of hurts, the longing for some love, the longing for some acceptance of themselves. And then I know again that they are like me, and I know it, and I pray that I may not forget it. Now, that's what you call a really fresh sermon there. That happened this morning. Took out my piece of paper and wrote that down. Fogel's argument about the Fourth Great Awakening is that as we include more and more people, then we have to be cognizant of the lowest 20% who are being left out and are of the economic explosion that's going on in the country. And that this Fourth Great Awakening is an awakening to the fact that you can't cure what ails people in the rich nations just with money, just with support. And so he's making an argument that for an economist is essentially religious. I believe it's religious anyway. Because then he says, what people who have been left behind economically, or people who are economically well off, but who have one of the diseases of our affluence, is that sometimes we don't have a sense of purpose. We don't know what we're here on earth to do. That we have shapeless doubts about our worth. So he says what is needed, and you already know this, this is why I've come to preach to you, that we need to cultivate and allow to grow in people the notion of a sense of purpose, to give them a sense of discipline, to develop within children the work ethic, the capacity to resist the lure of hedonistic consumption. We need to cultivate in the young a sense of knowing, a sense so that they can recognize where opportunities are and have confidence that they have the power to pursue them. That we must strengthen family, the family ethic, and nowhere more so than with single-parent families. We've got to give them, or find a way to let the mothers and the fathers make that commitment to love and care for their children. That spiritually we must develop within people the capacity for self-education, that they can make a commitment to learning, so they can believe in their capacity to succeed in an undertaking. And that money can't do that. That's moral education. Of course, it's what I call humanism. It's the recognition that these human beings are infinitely of worth and of value. But we need to have the ways to inculcate in every person that sense that they are of value, that they have these capacities, that they can find their communities whereby they can take action, continue to learn, continue to grow, continue to change. There is in our culture today what I would describe as a sense of melancholy, that we're uneasy with our affluence, that we're uneasy with the direction of the country, we worry about. In fact, our newspapers and our news is really filled up with the activity of the lowest 20% other than the kind of entertainment. But the entertainment values, we're entertaining ourselves to death, and the values that come from that are even more threatening. The melancholy consists of how will we escape the prison of the self. I'm not a humanist just as an individualist sort of way, because I believe human beings exist and live in community. They are formed and fashioned and made in community. I suppose that's why I became a minister, because I believe in community. I believe in people living rich lives in community. And one of the things that I have tried to do in my ministry is to ask questions, not just give answers, because I don't always have answers, but ask questions like, not what will I buy, but what will I become? And I believe that for us here and for all people, that's a good question. Not what will you buy, what will you become? What can you make? What can you do to make a contribution in this world? Let's just draw it to a close. I'll draw it to a close. You've got this, haven't you? Do I need to do any more? Do I need to stomp these grapes anymore and spew these things and this wine out on you, this mess? The best thing for being sad is to learn something. That is the only thing that never fails. You may grow old, lying in the bed, trembling in your anatomies. You may lie awake at night, listening to the very disorder of your veins. You may miss your only love. You may see the world about you devastated by evil lunatics, or know that your honor is trampled in the sewers of baser minds. There is only one thing to do, only one thing and one hope for you, and that is to learn why the world wags and what wags it. That is the only thing that the mind can never exhaust and never alienate, never be tortured by, never fear or distrust, and never dream of regretting. And that's all there is to it.